This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell.
In British Columbia, the minimum wage goes up $1.20 today, a 9.5% rise to $13.85. There's going to be the predictable date saying it's going to help people out of poverty. In fact, I had that chat earlier this morning with Jill Bennett on CKNW Vancouver. But just so you're clear, you won't find anyone who researches the subject, and there's been an avalanche of research on minimum wage increases, to say this is the most effective way to help those in poverty. I mean, StatCan says that only 13% of workers who earn minimum wage live in poverty, which means that for every $100 increase in minimum wage, what, $13 finds its way to people living in poverty? If poverty is truly the goal, then we should review every government policy, by the way, because there's so many that are hurtful for the poor. But in this case, if poverty is truly the goal, then direct transfers are a far more effective way to help. But I have my suspicions that's not really the goal. I could go on, but instead I want to focus on just one aspect that's bound to be overlooked. The impact of any rise in minimum wage is determined by a number of factors. The size of the increase, the ease of technological substitution, the overall demand in the labor market, and perhaps more importantly, the increase in other government-mandated costs for labor. And that's what I want to focus on today, not just for employment, but for some of the biggest areas of concern today. The minimum wage increase is on top of the new BC health tax paid by BC employers of businesses with payrolls over 500,000. Now, that tax is forecast to cost employers of small and medium and large businesses $2 billion a year. Now, that's on top of this minimum wage increase. Employers are also going to have to pay increases in the Canada Pension Plan premium, which is scheduled to rise, well, it is rising this year, but every year after for 6 years. Then there's the ever-increasing carbon tax that's no longer offset by reduced business taxes. This is on top of higher property taxes in big centers like Vancouver, other urban centers too, which already have forced some stores to close their door. It was the same problem for Calgary business that have, along with the mandated increase in minimum wage in 2015, they saw business taxes go up and other transfers like Canada Pension Plan. And given the federal government's promise to impose a carbon tax in Alberta, now that the provincial government's backed away from some of the specific aspects, small and mid-sized businesses should start factoring in that extra cost. I think only the most ill-informed don't understand that where possible, these costs are going to be passed along in the form of higher prices to consumers. Now, it could be fewer benefits for workers as their costs go up, or lower wage increases to non-minimum wage workers as there's not as much money left over, or layoffs or even possible business closures. As the higher prices are passed along, though, we're going to hear the familiar complaints that it's too expensive to live, without any appreciation for the role that government plays in making our life more expensive. Come on, we're seeing it right now when it comes to complaints about high gas prices, especially in BC, where gasoline taxes in Vancouver are the highest in North America. They got a transit levy that's going to go up from 17 cents a liter to 18.5 cents in July. This was a great thing, though. It was laughably, the BC government ordered the Utilities Commission to do an inquiry into gasoline prices, but the commission's not allowed to look into the role that government policies or taxes play. I mean, come on. The commission can't conclude that taxes and government policy play the biggest part in the price of the pump. And by the way, Alberta's new United Conservative government has done just the opposite by removing the 6.7 cent carbon tax from gas yesterday. And that puts that discrepancy between Calgary and Edmonton and Vancouver at about 55 cents a liter. That's how much they're paying more in Vancouver. But other policies, like regulations governing the composition of gasoline, most notably ethanol content, means that when supply shortages occur in BC, imported gasoline actually has to get treated further to meet the provincial standards. That may or may not be a good thing, but the regulations do increase the cost of gas. But next up, what about the constant talk about affordable housing? Because rarely do we hear, okay, outside of this show, about the taxes and government policies that increase the cost of housing. CD Howe Institute's study last year entitled Through the Roof, the High Cost of Barriers to Building New Housing in Canadian Municipalities, well, it calculates that the extra cost that taxes or zoning or permit delays, other regulations on new housing, the extra cost, is on average $229,000 for a new home in the 8 most restrictive cities. $600,000 plus in Vancouver, by the way. Government adds $264,000 to the cost of a new home in Victoria, $152,000 in Calgary. But what about the cost of other policies, this time at the federal level? Well, it's estimated that nearly a third of the Canadian economy is shielded from competition through tariffs and other restrictions. That keeps prices artificially high. Maybe milk marketing boards are the prime example, where the government imposes a 241% tax on American milk exports that are above the quota. I mean, the average Canadian family pays over $500 more per year for dairy products thanks to tariffs on American competition. Hey, but maybe we shouldn't feel so bad. One of the big stories this week is how Donald Trump is threatening again more tariffs on Mexican goods. This is on top of the tariffs on the Chinese goods. The estimate is that it's going to cost U.S. consumers an extra $72 billion this year. But the point is this: government policies that extend way beyond income tax play a major role in increasing the cost of living that we hear so many complaining about. As Ronald Reagan famously said, the nine scariest words in the English language: I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Rob Levy joins me on the line. Rob, I'm going to just throw this one right at you. What the heck's happening to beer drinkers?
That's a good question, Mike. It was a huge story this week. Anheuser-Busch InBev, the biggest brewer in the world, with the headline, they have to look beyond beers in order to drive revenues at a $160 billion company. They say they're looking at, you know, interesting trends in the market, like do-it-yourself cocktails or different ways in order to sell craft beer in order to drive revenues. But, you know, I think the reason, too, this headline stands out and, you know, flashes maybe some signs of red is, you know, is it yet another big multinational giant that's with a similar theme here in the markets? It's, you know, they're massive. They've taken on debt to make acquisitions and grow, but, you know, revenues here are stalling, and it's no different, you know, with stalling beer drinkers across the world.
So literally people are drinking less beer in their volumes there?
That was their story. I mean, around the world, they've got beer sales down 2.2% in 2018. In the U.S. market, it was the steepest decline in beer volumes in the last 7 years. So to answer that question in short, yes, people are drinking less beer. They are drinking more of things like gin and whiskey. So, you know, spirits and wine are up, and that's the reason, you know, Anheuser-Busch has to look somewhere else. But in the answer in short, yes, people are drinking less beer.
It's going to be interesting. We don't have the stats from Canada yet. Obviously, it's too early days. But, you know, come out a couple of years, and if recreational marijuana is also going to eat into the entire liquor market, it'll be just interesting to see. But as you say, there's competition now, gin, whiskey, but wine drinkers seem to be more prominent than they have in the past.
Yeah, absolutely right. And just to relate to that, I mean, then you got big names like Constellation Brands, and one of their biggest investments over the last couple of years has been, you know, acquiring shares in Canopy Growth, the major Canadian grower of marijuana. So as you said, you know, another way to find ways to grow in the stalling beer market is going into your competitor's market or taking a position in them.
Well, you know, you mentioned this right off the top. I mean, is this going to be another one of these big companies that sort of really struggles? Because the other thing that I know about Anheuser-Busch is it's got a lot of debt.
They do. At the beginning of this year, $102.5 billion in debt. And part of that, you know, made up from the fact that they did a $79 billion acquisition of Anheuser-Busch, Sab Miller, back in 2016. So, you know, this has been a common theme in the financial markets since the financial crisis, is these companies that have seen stalling revenue growth. So what's a way in order in which we can grow our business is we take on debt, record low interest rates to finance an acquisition, and we combine companies. You know, we sell it to shareholders with the idea of synergies or major cost savings because we're, you know, combining two big brands and we've got double the market, so we can sell to more people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look at that and you look at a company like Anheuser-Busch, and, you know, sales up 1.6% in the U.S. last year, and they were down 0.7% the year before. So almost awaiting these major cost savings. And the big question, you know, given that they've taken on debt to do it, is will they come?
Well, just let me transition to something else here, is that one of the reasons I'm sort of seeing a lot of concern about the quality of corporate debt in general out there, that, you know, if we come into a bit of a credit crunch coming up or what have you. But I just know there's a lot of investment analysts who are now starting to get uncomfortable that, you know, it's sort of like 2006, 7, 8 again, in terms of there's a lot of sort of lower grade corporate debt out there.
Exactly right, Mike. And those were the warnings this week. In 2018, the lowest level of speculative grade debt, so one level above the lowest grade of junk status, represented 44% of new issuance. And, you know, you say similar to 2005, 2006. I mean, that number is double the level it was in 2007 before the financial crisis. And, you know, those things you talk about referring to the debt markets, you know, quality of debt, you know, late cycle characteristics, you know, all very sort of scary warning signs for investors, and they're almost flashing red a little bit, because does it tell you that, you know, there could be some trouble, or if there was a turn lower in the market for some reason, slower revenues, or companies need to refinance, you know, are they in a position where there is a bit of a credit crunch, or they find themselves in trouble?
And that in turn, back to what I alluded to just for briefly in the my little comment there, was that, you know, that's what I think is worrying the central banks about the trade wars. You know, whether it's with Mexico, the latest tariffs announced, but obviously bigger with China, not bigger for the States, by the way. Mexico's the U.S. is number one trade partner, but just for the global economy, you know, the China-U.S. spat, too. I mean, it's these things. The more debt you get into, the less you can handle, I guess, economic shocks.
Exactly right. And every warning, you know, with these increase in tariffs, whether we're talking U.S., China, or the news with Mexico on Friday, and, you know, who knows how that's going to play out. But the estimates then that go with that is, what kind of chunk does that take out of demand, out of growth, is absolutely the warning sign.
Well, on that cheerful note, thanks. No, no, important stuff to keep an eye on, and also for people to then review their own portfolios and see, are they a little overexposed in these areas? Rob, go out and have a beer.
We'll do. Thanks, Mike.
Anheuser-Busch will send a thank you note. Time now for this installment of Instant Wisdom. Just looking at a Mammoth University poll this past couple of weeks, it showed that about 30% of Americans prefer socialism to capitalism. That's fairly consistent with an Axios Harris online survey in late February that found 37% of Americans. Same poll, though, here's the thing, found that those, when it came to people between the ages of 18 and 24, the favor of socialism over capitalism rose dramatically. Maybe that's not a surprise, given the massive shift left on university campuses. Now see a 12-to-1 ratio of professors who identify as left-wing compared to those that identify as conservative. Well, that brings me to a piece, and I've shared this with you before. It's by Campus Reform, but I thought it went to the heart of this. It's really interesting. They went to Florida International University to get students' reaction to socialism. But then they asked how they'd feel if it applied to them, especially their grade point average. Well, I thought it was important, again, to revisit, because the assumption underlying a support of socialism that it's always going to impact somebody else. And as this piece shows, when it applies to them, support starts to evaporate. Have a listen.
I'm Kevin Phillips with Campus Reform. Today we're at Florida International University talking to students about their opinions of socialism and if they'd support a socialist GPA policy. Would they be willing to share their high GPA with people that have a low GPA? Because after all, it's all about equality.
Which would you rather have in America, socialism or capitalism?
I would say socialism.
How do you view the word socialism, favorably or unfavorably?
I guess I would go with favorably.
Like, I have family in Europe. They go to college for free. Their healthcare is paid for. They don't have to worry about it at all.
I favor that over capitalism.
Okay, got it.
I also think I favor that, like, socialism over capitalism.
Socialism is more geared toward, like, helping the people in your, you know, the governed.
I'd rather people have that same opportunity. There's a lot of excess in America.
The main idea of socialism being that people at the top are doing their fair share to help people at the bottom, trying to prevent disparity of income and trying to prevent excess, as you called it. So on campus, if there's a GPA disparity where there's people at the bottom with a poor GPA, would you support a policy where people at the top spread the wealth and give that GPA to people at the bottom?
Give, like, help them get a better GPA?
Yeah.
I'm all for helping. I wouldn't give, like, oh, let me just give you some of my poor.
But it's about being fair, right? We got to help people at the bottom.
I've lost a lot of sleep, so I don't know if I will be fair.
It's hard. If I guess it would be kind of, like, hypocritical for me to say no.
That's completely different.
How is it different?
Because I'm, like, studying all day for my grade.
What do you mean by sharing it? Like, literally, like, giving them a chunk of my GPA?
Yep.
Dang.
I would want to say no straight up.
But what's the difference between earning a high GPA and not wanting to give it away, but then earning a lot of money and also not wanting to give that away?
Well, I feel like the difference is that you study for your grades, right? And grades often reflect how much time you spend studying. But
you gotta work pretty hard to become a millionaire.
I mean, I'm not denying that fact either, but for the regular working person, you know.
Do you think there's a similarity between earning your salary and maybe not wanting to give it away to people that aren't working to earn it? And same thing with the GPA, where you earn it and you say, well, I don't necessarily want to give it to anyone who might not be working for it.
Right. I think it's just that whole sense of thinking that no one's going to work for it.
I mean, I sacrifice a lot to get my GPA. You know, I don't go out as much as I'd like to, but that's for something like a greater goal in the future, the way I see it. So, no, I wouldn't sacrifice my own things, like sacrifice my own time to help somebody else who didn't want to make those same sacrifices.
As I say, it's kind of interesting. As long as people think it's somebody else who's going to do it, somebody else is going to pay for it, all of these things, they have one attitude. When it comes back to themselves, I think it's a different attitude altogether. Time now for this week's quote of the week. For me personally, watching children used as political props, and I think most recently in the service of climate alarmism, brings to mind the quote by Harlem-born, raised, famed Stanford economist Thomas Sowell, in quotes, I think we're raising whole generations who regard facts as more or less optional. They're being taught that it's important to have views, and they're not being taught that it's important to know what you're talking about, end of quote. A year or two later, he followed that up by saying, it is usually futile to try to talk facts and analysis to people who are enjoying a sense of moral superiority in their ignorance. Well, you might remember this one, in an effort to unwittingly prove his point, earlier this year, when interviewed on 60 Minutes, leading Democrat media darling Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was asked about her numerous factual errors, and she responded by saying, in quotes, I think that there's a lot of people more concerned about being precisely factually and semantically correct than about being morally right, in quotes. Now, talk about underlying Thomas Sowell's observation, it's usually futile to talk facts and analysis to people who are enjoying a sense of moral superiority in their ignorance. Welcome to the age of progressive politics. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Joseph Schachter, Schachter Energy. First of all, Joseph, I just wanted to start and acknowledge and thank you for your help with Special Olympics. It's very kind of you, and I can tell you it is more than just needed. I mean, it's a profound influence on so many people with and their families who have intellectual disabilities. So thank you for that.
Oh, Patty and I are very pleased to have done that and supporting again. This wonderful effort you've done.
Great stuff. And by the way, I should have said this off the top. You can find Schachter is spelled S-C-H-A-C-H-T-E-R energyreport.ca, schachterenergyreport.ca. Hey, Joseph, last time you were with us here on the air, it was later in December, and you were talking about tax loss selling as being the time to pick up, and you said, buy a half your positions right now. I still think there's another dip to come, but I love the market in the meantime. Well, wow, those energy shots, you did very well for our listeners and, of course, for your readers of the Schachter Energy Report.
Yeah, it was quite something. We got very oversold, of course, because of the general stock market malaise, and crude oil got down to 42.36, and it rallied into April on the, you know, the Iran sanctions and also the, you know, strong winter demand to 66.60. So it was up 57%. And the S&P TSX Energy Index went up 35%, so that was a quite move. But some of the names that have been to the World Outlook Financial Conference and our conference had fabulous returns. Birchcliff Energy, if you remember, they were at the World Outlook the last 2 years, up 57%. In play, Doug Bartoli, who's been there for almost forever at the conference, up 63%. Questair up 140%. Surge, a dividend play, up 38% plus the dividend. Whitecap up 61% plus the dividend, and Vermilion, you know, very big dividend play, one of the highest yields we have out there, almost over 9%, up 42% plus the dividend over that period. So we had such a fabulous run, and the market got ahead of itself at 66.60 on WTI that people were starting to only localize their thought process on Iran and sanctions and potential supply disruptions. And then, of course, you had the attack on those four ships and then the missile attack in Syria in against Saudi Arabia. So everybody was worried about supply. They weren't realizing that inventories were building substantially in the United States. and because of the, you know, the growing production profile there, and also we're in the shoulder season where demand is weakening, and inventories rose quite sharply in the States, and that is why we started seeing the price erode. And now with the trade war with Mexico, and now the, and of course on top of that China, everybody's worried about economic slowdown around the world. So WTI is fallen down to 53.5, which on Friday, which is down 20%. The TSX Energy Index has fallen by about 17%, and I think we're getting ready potentially in June or July, probably July, for another great buying opportunity similar to what we got during tax loss selling season of November, December of 2018.
Well, I read the Schachter Energy report in April, and that's when you got cautious again there. So it's interesting for me to hear that, you know, you think this is a, you know, the move will be coming where we want to get back into the stocks.
Yeah, I think that people should be building positions over time. We don't know when we're going to see, you know, the real powerful leg up like we saw, you know, the bull market of 1999 to 2008. 1999 to about 2003 was more like a yo-yo market up and down, and you needed to take advantage of the bottoms that happened during that period. But once we got to 2003, it was like up and away, and the, you know, of course, the price of oil went from, you know, $17 to $147. The index went up four times, and things like CNQ went up 25 times from the low to the high. So the big move is going to happen at some point. My thinking is 2020, 2021, we'll be looking at very strong prices of $80 to $100 on WTI, and AECO, the NYMEX, and the natural gas prices will move, you know, from 250, 260 on NYMEX to 354, and AECO could go from, you know, sub $2 now to $3 or $4, and that's when the big money will be made. But it'll be hard to chase them. So what we're recommending to investors is to do is to take advantage of these cracks in the market. And this one, of course, will probably be because of Trump and the trade war with Mexico and weaker economic concerns. But we have two indices that we watch to see when that buy signal is going to occur. One of them is the bullish percentage energy index. And any time it gets into the 70 or 80 range, it's getting, you know, fully valued in terms of stocks. And it's a clear sell signal at 90%. When it gets below 10%, it's a buy signal. In 6 weeks, 7 weeks, in from October of 2018 to November, December, in 7 weeks, we went down to 3%. So we had a very strong buy signal, both in late November and then December. At the high in April, when we had the peak at 66.60, we were 76%. And on Friday's close, we were sitting there at 27%. So to get down to, you know, below 10%, you know, could take a few weeks. And if we get a signal below 5%, it'll be, you know, we'll send out action alert buys to all of our subscribers, telling them time to buy again. And buy a diversified portfolio. Look at some of the income-oriented names, names that we've talked before about, things like Vermilion, Whitecap, and Surge. Buy some of the service stocks, you know, things like Trican and Step, and look at some of the international names like Gran Tierra, Canacol, and Touchstone. So there's a nice mix of names you can buy, but please make sure you take advantage and diversify. And plus, make sure the largest capital allocations are to the largest, most liquid names.
Well, you just preempted the question I was going to ask. I just want to reiterate. So with your subscribers, what you do is you watch these indicators, and then you do send out your buy signal at that point.
Correct. Yeah, okay. And we send out action alerts when we add new names to our action alert list. Right now, we cover 31 names, and on our action alert list, we are sitting with 24 names. And then a subset of that, which I want people to see what we're doing, you know, in terms of our own personal accounts, we have 11 names in our on our SER ownership disclosure, and the biggest weighting is towards those large caps.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing, by the way, in your newsletter, the Schachter Energy Report. I think that's a great thing because I'm always interested in that. You know, and I ask Victor Adair every week what he's doing with his money, as an example, you know, and I just think that's a great thing that you add on to your report. So I just throw that out. I want you to come back to the indicator again for a sec because you that went by pretty darn quickly. So what you're looking at is when the market gets negative, when the whole sentiment goes the opposite of what you want to do. So if we're buyers, we want to wait till a time that we see just there's huge negative overhanging the market. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so if you, for those people who are using stock charts or even any of the other services that are out there, I use stockcharts.com. And so that's www.stockcharts.com for people who want to take a look at the service. And it's available, you know, at a very reasonable price. And they have an index which is called the, it's a $BPENER, which is the S&P Energy Stock Bullish Percentage Index. And I've been following this index for probably 20-plus years, and whenever it gets into the 80 range, it's telling you warning signals that, you know, the market's getting pretty effervescent. It gets over 90, it's a clear sell signal, and anytime it gets under 10, it says, you know, pull out your shopping basket, and if it gets below 5%, it's time to trigger and make the buys. And so that's what we recommended to our investors in November, December. The same thing happened in February of 2016. And if you remember, in April or May of 2014, I got very bearish. And that was because we were in the 90s, 92, 93%. And so that was when I got bearish. And we talked about that at the time, at, you know, in the February World Outlook Financial Conference, that things were looking very toppy. It's time to sell and walk away. So, you know, this is these cyclical industries like the energy area and the precious metals. There are periods of times when they're trading areas, and then there's periods of times that they're long-term investing ones. I think we're starting a new energy bull market cycle. We're in the skepticism phase. The bottom was in February of 2016 at $26. And I think that before this is over in 2023, 2025 range, we're going to be above the 147 a barrel price that we saw in Q2 of 2008. So I think there's a massive upside coming, and I think people should be looking at the whole commodity sector, because the, both energy and precious metals and rare earths, we have underinvestment for decades in terms of putting money in the ground to reinvest to replace the decline rates, and that is the, effectively the bullish case, because the reserve life indices in energy have gone from, in the 1970s, 14 to 16 years, and we're now looking at 5 to 6 years for proven reserve life. And so the proven reserves, a subset of that is proved developed producing, is now at the lowest it's been in 40 years.
Well, I think it's interesting also is it sort of runs contrary to what people think, is the more people, what you're really measuring when you say 93% are bullish is there's not many people left to buy. If that many people are excited about it, there's not many left, and that gives you an indicator that you're at the top, and it's straightforward. So it's the old, you know, when your neighbors are talking to you about it, or you know, a cab driver who doesn't necessarily invest very often, or the grocery store person next to you, well, then you know that there's not many people left who can push that price higher. And so that's why it's sort of interesting to hear that. You just wait till it gets really bullish, you know, okay, that's giving me an idea I should sell. Or in the case you just mentioned, you know, you got down to bearishness where only 3% were keen on oil. You thought, well, this is a good time to get in. And I just think that's fascinating for people to hear. Joseph, one of the other things you're saying, which I think is very important for people to understand, is that if you're an oil trader, you're looking for tick downs and ticks up and all of this, but you're talking about investing in an oil market that could have, as you say, has started a long-term bull market. Well, in that case, you do things a little differently. You know, as you say, you look to buy on dips. You relax when that dip happens, that kind of thing. Traders know they're active, and Victor knows that so well, explains it to us very well every week. But you're talking about creating and building a position and, you know, holding it through a bull market, which our friend Dim Dimes would give you a big check mark for that. And you mentioned a couple of names to us, and we've only got about 4 or 5 minutes here, but I wanted you, could you walk through a few, could you walk back that somewhat for us?
Yeah, the way that I approach it is that I want to own, because of age and income, I want to own quite a few names that are the dividend payers. And so you want to buy the companies that have sustainable dividends, that have historic history of paying them in the bad times when we're down at, you know, $26 oil, like we were in February of 2016. And so the majority of one's assets should be in those names, diversified, you know, potentially if they, to the degree you can. So the names that we really like are names like Vermilion Energy. Vermilion is a $4.3 billion company. It pays 23 cents a month, so that's 276. On Friday's close at 28.34, it's a 9.7% yield. Now, we started recommending this at $34. When we initiated coverage on it, but we also said at the time that on dips we would add to the position and build it up. And so from Whitecap, which we recommended in November of 2018, we're now saying to people, buy on any time you see it below 30, and it's a table pounding buy anytime it's below 28. Other names that we like are Whitecap Resources, which is an oil-focused company. 84% of production is oil and liquids, 7.6% dividend yield. Surge Energy, which is a company of $400 million market cap, the smallest of the three, but it's got 84% liquids. It pays, it pays 10 cents annually divided monthly, 7.8% dividend yield. So you can find a lot of these names that are providing you with decent dividend yields. And then at the same time, add to that exploration kind of names, as I mentioned earlier, the Grand Tierra, the Canacol, the Touchstone. And then you can also add some of the service sector names, Trican, Step, Precision Drilling, have some exposure right across the board. In our case, as I mentioned, we own about 11 names right now. My expectation is I will be adding to those 11 names on the next dip when we get the action alert buy signal from that energy bullish percentage number. And then the other thing is probably we will be adding some additional names because we have no exposure at this time in our portfolio to the energy service sector. And that's an area that I think we want to have some exposure to for the cycle. So we're taking advantage of any time you have these shakeouts, buy on the dips, build your positions, and then, you know, right now sometimes it's going to, when you have these up and downs in the market, it's not going to look very pretty, but the key thing is you're buying for 5 to 8 years of an energy bull market, and you're not looking to be buying for, only 20%, 30% upside. You're looking to be buying them for 5 to 10 times upside, and as I mentioned earlier, CNQ had 50% up and down moves during that skepticism phase. So, you know, if you bought it and it went down 50%, you're probably feeling pretty horrible and saying, what kind of a dumb idea was that? But then if you held it for the 6-7 years of the cycle, you had 25 times your money. CNQ. Wow. People can just pull it out on the charts and see what it did from 1999 to 2008. There's other examples. You can look at the Suncor. You can look at all the names, you know, we've talked about. Names that have come to the World Outlook Financial Conference, Birchcliff, in play, a lot of painted pony. A lot of these companies have done very well in previous cycles. They're now all in, trading at extremely low valuations relative to history. And it's, the bad politics in Canada, the egress issues. I think we all know all the reasons. The negatives are there. Nobody's flipping the coin and saying, what are the positives? If we get egress resolved with LNG takeaway capacity on the West Coast, which I think is probably likely, LNG Canada may even announce phase two this summer, we're probably going to get Trans Mountain approved. I think Trudeau wants to get reelected, so he's got to throw a bone to the industry. I think XL Pipeline will probably get built in the next few years. And there's lots of new capacity coming on for takeaway on natural gas outside of that. So I think people are too pessimistic. And I think when we, when we look out at the back, 4 or 5 years from now to what we are now, people say, my God, they were unbelievable bargains. Why didn't I buy them? That's what we're trying to do, is provide a service of showing you where the value is. And even if there's going to be some drawdowns because of market problems, be there, because there's going to be tremendous upside.
Well, that's why ShachterEnergyReport.ca, S-C-H-A-C-H-T-E-R, EnergyReport.ca. Great stuff with Joseph Schachter. By the way, he also does his great energy conference. It's going to be October 19th this coming. That seems like the summer's a long way off, but October 19th. And go for more information. Go to mikesmoneytalks.ca or moneytalks.net, because there is a special on that right now. In the meantime, have a terrific weekend, Joseph. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much as well.
Hey, just a reminder, I mentioned this earlier in the show, but in case you didn't catch it, I'm really excited about this, because I had an idea going back a few weeks, and I said, why don't I ask some of the people that we use, like Don Violo, John Johnston, Greg Weldon, Lance Roberts, you just heard Joseph Schachter, Martin Mierenbild, Martin Straith, Tyler Bullhorn, Patrick Cerisna, we asked Ozzy, Ryan Irvine, and Eric Coffin, all put together. We were looking at what's going to happen in the rest of 2019. So much stuff going on about investing, certain areas, that kind of thing. So we put together a special report, 13 different little sections on it. And it's absolutely free. I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm just saying, just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca, and we have the free e-service there. But I think you're going to really like it. It's a time-sensitive report, and it's great stuff. One other thing very quickly before I get to the shocking stat of the week. Just my thanks to people like Joseph Schachter, but my friend Anthony Beirutti of Venue Kings. Talk about an entrepreneur who's built an incredible business. Anthony Beirutti, thanks for your help with Special Olympics. Craig Burrow, you hear here in TriView. Howard Fitch, Capital Event Management, thanks for helping us out with the Special Olympics golf tournament. Jeff Olin, you know him. Jamie Switzer of Canaccord Genuity. Paul Gill, Lamico Metals, Danielle Park, we heard a couple of weeks ago, who does a great job every time she's on the air. Ryan Irvine, our friend of Keystone Financial, Jatinder Rai of Response Advertising. Thanks, Jatinder. Robin Mike Levy, of course, help us. Eamon Piercy of the Piercy Group always helps. Andrew Rulin, you hear him from Integrated Wealth Management. As I just mentioned, Tyler Bullhorn, Jeff Olin, Eric Coffin. Just really, it's so much appreciated, and so many more who made donations to Special Olympics. Unfortunately, it's a year-long thing, but I just want to acknowledge them. And these are people making a commitment to our communities, and it's important. I could go, as you know, I was just going to say I could go on. I think you know I can go on and on with that, but as I say, very important to us. Time now for this week's shocking stat. You know, I've said it for years. I think retail has to be the toughest business in the world. I mean, any day I drive along, I think, man, that's tough. I mean, there's so much competition. You got massive impact of online shopping. No kidding. And as I said off the top today, you got governments at all three levels treat businesses like it's a cash cow. You got rising property taxes at the municipal level. Provincially, you got these mandated wage increases. But there's other things. As I mentioned, in BC, they just added the new employer's health care tax. Federally, there's the constant rise in payroll taxes. Small and mid-sized businesses are going to pay the federal carbon tax. In BC, they're going to pay the carbon tax. I don't know how they do it, really. But obviously, some don't, as we hear about store foreclosures all the time. I just can't imagine what it'd be like if you're struggling and then the government steps in and makes it worse. I really can't. Think about this number. It's my shocking stat. 7,150. That's the number of store foreclosures in the U.S. in only 5 months this year. 7,150. It's big and small. Local retailers to big names like Pier 1 or The Gap, Macy's, CVS, The Dress Barn, all closing stores. And listen to this. The all-time record for store closures was in 2017. That was at 8,139. But that was for 12 months. We're 85% there in only 5 months. As I say, what's incredible is to see governments in both the U.S. and Canada saying how much they care about jobs and small business, but then add to the cost through a series of taxes. It might be tariffs, especially in the case of the U.S. and China right now. I mean, it's incredible. Which brings me back to that Reagan quote I just used. The 9 scariest words in the English language. I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Not. Ozzie Jurek joins me live on the line. You know me, Ozzie. I get to this. We've had beautiful weather. You've had out in British Columbia great weather, but the summer is coming. You know, people are going to start dreaming about, wouldn't it be great to own a little vacation property? We could be talking whether I'm going to buy in Canmore. I could buy in Kimberley. I could buy out in the coast in one of the Gulf Islands. But let's talk about some of the do's and don'ts there. One of the first things that jumps out at me is it doesn't matter where I buy, I got to get there.
Well, it's so true. I mean, that happens every summer. You lay there on a beach with your significant other and she says, or you say, we should buy something here. At that moment, your partner should get a sharp stick and poke you in the eye. The pain that is incurred is a lot less sometimes than that property, but primarily because you forgot it took you 3 ferries to get to that beautiful Texada island where you are at, or you're on a no ferry island. Or the difference between the islands, it could be on Saturna, which is gorgeous in BC, wonderful sandstone formation, long stretches of old growth forests. Or you could be on Bowen Island, where you have a fast ferry that's part of the West End School District. You know, so many more things you can do, but 2 things quickly on islands. First of all, in Canada, you don't own the beach. Most people think I buy this beachfront and it's mine. No, it isn't. All properties at the high water mark and below belong to all of us. So Is it a party beach in the summer right in front of you? Is it low bank? Is the beach leased? Does it have sensitive shorelines? Can you build there? Because you might have a nice 100 by 100 foot lot, but you have to be 100 feet away from the high water mark before you can build. Ergo, you can't build there. So it's important, like with all real estate, you should figure out what to invest, where to invest. And when you go to Canmore, any of the resorts, they have certain reasons why they want more people in, more accommodation available in the winter if they're a ski resort, or in the summer like a Soyuz, and they have rules. So maybe you can only use the property for 28 days in the summer and the winter. All of those things are important for you to enjoy your property to find out first.
Yeah, but I just know it's really interesting, the emotional appeal. As you say, you're lying on the beach, it just feels so great. But there's so much to it, though. I mean, one of the things that I lucked into, I bought a place 21 years ago. BC government says I'm speculating. But anyways, I bought a place 21 years ago. And I got lucky because of judging where the sun was. I mean, I happened to get the south facing, but I can honestly say I didn't check it out. So when the first time I went there in winter, I realized all the adjacent properties were in darkness almost all day. Ours wasn't. As I say, I got lucky, but that's one of the things I learned, and I thankfully didn't have to learn that one the hard way.
Well, you're so right. And you of course, with the whole purchase, I mean, you should talk the details about one day and tell people what a magnificent investor you are. But that aside, maybe West is best where you are. In Secret Cove, for instance, there's an area where it is sun all day round, and then there's sort of a cut into the mountain like a fjord, and there's no sun, right? So that's very important to you. But also in all recreational properties, people say, is there a well? Great. But is there just enough to brush your teeth, the water flow? Or do you have 10 gallons an hour, right, where you can have a bath? So is it shallow? Is it deep? Is it produce water in the summer at all? You know, how many wells are competing? Or septic fields? I've seen so many problems with septic fields, you know. How old is the septic field? Has it ever been pumped out in the last 5 years? All of those kind of things, you know, is it below your house, above your house? All of those kind of things, you ask those questions before you buy.
Well, but really important practical questions that you're bringing to light here, that all we're saying here is, hey, I know it would be great, but let's do it the right way. As you say, you know, how are you going to get there? You know, what about the beach? You want to build? Are you part of the code? How far do you have to be from the water mark? Where's the sun, the water, and the sewage? Water and sewage, two monster check marks here, Aussie, you know, that you're talking about.
Most people think they can be on the recreational property and they can just build anything. But in BC, any building over 108 feet needs a building permit, right? So if you buy one and you don't have one, and if city finds out, maybe you won't have one anymore. You have to take it down, right?
Well, I just, you know, a neighbor at our, you know, in our place where we use in the summer, our neighbor took over a year and a half to get that building permit. It was ready to go, everything, still just didn't get processed. You know, didn't have any problems with
it.
He did get it, but it's still, you have to be careful about all of that kind of stuff. Hey, let me just say very quickly here, you know, there's a lot of, well, as I say, it doesn't matter where you're buying. All of these things play a role. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, Aussie, you've been in Kimberley so many years in the beautiful area there, whether you're commuting from Calgary into Canmore, into Kimberley, or you've come out to the West Coast from Vancouver, you're into an island there. I mean, there's lots of fabulous places, but as I say, our message is do some homework on this stuff. How about some hot properties?
Yeah, well, this is a little bit different. We're going at the upper end, you know, where we have discussed that a lot of the pain in the Vancouver market has been at the upper end. But to give you an idea, in West Vancouver, 3,600 square foot house, great views, assessed at $2.8 million in 2017, $2.5 million last year, and now it's for sale at $1.9 million. So 1.990, I should say, million. And then you have another unique one in Victoria. There's a house, 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom on 4.4 acres and only 796,000. But there's a question, and the question was that there was cannabis grown in the basement in the 80s. Is that good or bad? Well, in this new environment, hey, there may be a real deal there. And you'll find throughout the North Shore in Vancouver at the upper end, assessed at 2.5, now for sale at 2.2. And a lot of those properties, there's one in particular at 2.198 with a pool, great views, 10,000 square foot lot, and it's down some 200,000 below assessment. So there are opportunities for you to choose out at the upper end too.
Ozzie Jurek, you go out and have a wonderful weekend. I know you will. I just hope you're not golfing. That's all I can say.
It's true, but I want to leave you with that thought. In beer, there is freedom. In wine, there's health. In cognac, there's power. But in water, there's just bacteria.
Victor Dare joins me on the line right now. Victor, got a bit of a shock in the markets yesterday when Donald Trump, I think out of nowhere, announces this escalating tariffs against Mexico starting June 10th at 5%, could go to 25% by October 1st. The markets didn't like that much.
No, they didn't. The U.S. dollar soared against the peso. I guess the peso was down about 3.5% on the day. And the uncertainty and the, let's call it just tensions that Trump's surprise announcement brought about caused an extension in the tumble that we've seen in the stock market and caused an extension in the rally that we've seen in the bond market. So interest rates are falling. The market's certainly now pricing in that the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates by a quarter in September, do it again in December. And but I guess maybe what we've seen is a month ago, the S&P 500 was touching all-time highs. We've fallen back about 7%, and there's kind of been nothing but really bearish news, whether it's China, Mexico, growing economies, that sort of thing. But the decline has been 7% from all-time highs. There hasn't been any panic, at least in the stock market. It certainly seems there's been some panic over in the crude oil pits. So it's this sort of a reasonable decline, 7% from all-time highs. We're still up 10% from the beginning of the year on the S&P. And, you know, that's how it is. I think there's been a really interesting correlation between the bond market and the crude market. You know, Joseph, my longtime friend, talking with you there earlier, when crude touched $66 and started the rollover, as crude was falling and we got down to below $54 this week, that was when the bond market was really taking the rocket boosters to the upside, the rally there. So real interesting correlation. As crude oil fell, the bond market was rallying. I'll tell you what, if there's one thing I'm looking at here across markets is I'm seeing the U.S. dollar looking a little toppy. And that certainly showed up in the gold market this week. We jumped to two-week highs on gold. So there's a lot going on, that's for sure, at whatever market you looked at.
Well, tell me just very quickly, Vic, what you're doing.
I came the one-minute version. I had put last week. I put on a little basket of currencies against the U.S. dollar. I was thinking the U.S. dollar looked toppy. I was just wrong on that. And as I said last week, if I'm wrong, I'm gone fast. I was gone by Monday morning. I thought, no, I don't think that's working. I was short the stock market for a chunk this week, more than recovered the losses I took on Monday. I'm going into next week again with my toe in the water, thinking that the U.S. dollar is a little toppy. And by the way, Mike, I got to say, my son Drew has just had a fabulous month here or two with the trading that he's done. He's been much more patient than I have been. He's stayed with his bearish positions on stocks, bullish positions on bonds, and he was positioned the right way on the Mexican peso this week. So he's going off on a honeymoon next week, and he's going to have a big smile on his face.
I bet he is on that one. My goodness gracious. Victor, you go out and have a terrific weekend.
Thank you, Mike.
Okay. Time now for this week's Goofy Award. Before I get to that, though, I got to thank Doug Peters. Luna Vista is the name of his place, but he's been so helpful to us of Special Olympics. Doug, I can't tell you how much I do appreciate that and the people. Obviously, the families and the people over in Quadra Island. What a beautiful place. He's got a couple of cabins there that he rents out. Absolutely gorgeous. Go to lunavista.ca for that on Quadra Island. But, Doug, we much appreciate it. Okay, now I can get to this week's Goofy Award. In this week's latest ripple in the SNC-Lavalin case, the company's going to face criminal prosecution. But the bigger news concerned the decisions by former Liberal Attorney General Justice Minister Jody Wilson-Raybould, former head of the Treasury Board, Jim Philpott, to run as independents. I'll tell you, it garners a great deal of respect for me that. They both have shown the same commitment to principle over expediency and the choice not to take the easy political road that they displayed during the height of the SNC-Lavalin crisis. I mean, come on, it would have been easier. Absolutely phony, though, but easier to run for another party. What I find goofy, though, is the lazy talk in much of the commentariat and individuals who eat and breathe politics is that they should have run for the Greens, as if Jane Philpott supported for 1 minute the Greens' primary policy, and that is opposition to all pipelines, along with the stated goal to not support, in Elizabeth May's words, the production of a single drop of additional oil. They don't support major policies of the Conservatives or NDP, so how could they, in good conscience, which they both showed in the SNC-Lavalin case, run for another party? I congratulate them. I applaud and respect their choice, once again, for principle over political expediency. It is a breath of fresh air. My thanks to James Murray for all the help he gives on the show, and I hope you go out and have a terrific weekend.
Subscribe to the Money Talks with Michael Campbell podcast for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you get your on-demand audio. For the complete show, daily podcasts, and more.